But in terms of sales, I always tell people to get a sales job before they try to build their own business, because you might as well learn, from somebody else's established process that they've probably paid consultants hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars to develop. And also, it's a low risk test environment for you.
Welcome to Lessons in Leverage, the podcast that takes you behind the scenes of success. We'll help you unlock the secrets of leverage so you can amplify your impact in the world. Here's your host, Spencer Lowe.
Welcome back to another episode of Lessons in Leverage. I'm excited today to be joined by Maddie Osman. She is a digital content maven and the founder and CEO of The Blogsmith. She went from teaching herself web design at the age of 11 to becoming one of the top 100 content marketers recognized by SEMrush and BuzzSumo. Maddie's transformed her passion for content creation into actionable insights for enterprise B2B technology brands. And her book, Writing for Humans and Robots, embodies her journey and dedication to crafting quality, accessible content, drawing on experiences with leading brands like Automattic, HubSpot, and Adobe. Maddie, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for having me, and I loved your rendition of my bio.
Well, I had to write it and then edit it slightly. I had AI write it. I have AI do most.
Oh, actually, nice. I
have it write my invitations for the podcast. I've never actually shared. Yeah, I have it do a lot of stuff for me. I'm very big on that. But as you know well, it requires some editing after the fact in many cases. So, I would love to start out just with sharing a little bit about your story and journey to the audience. Maybe going back to your childhood. I think most of us get into entrepreneurship. There's often ties back into early into our upbringing, our how we view the world. And then that opens up the ability for us later to kind of discover these higher leverage mindsets and opportunities. So where did it really start for you?
I think for me, it started with my dad. So he was an entrepreneur. He started his own business and he modeled the behavior, right? Like the fact that was even possible to do, because it wasn't really something that I had thought that I would do for myself until probably like college or even beyond that. But without having that like critical piece, learning it from my dad, I don't know that I would have ever gone this direction.
That makes sense. So, I mean, most people, one of the patterns I've seen in interviewing really successful people is it's crazy how just seeing something changes everything for you. So it's not uncommon that whether it's a father, a friend, someone, when you see someone do it, it makes it an option. It makes it real and possible. So at what point, you said that kind of you didn't start necessarily down the path of like, well, since my dad did it, that's what I'm going to do. Where did your journey, that switch kind of flip for you? What were you pursuing? And then where did you decide, okay, maybe I need to look at entrepreneurship?
Totally. So I went to school and I knew that I wanted to be a business major. I didn't know what aspect of business I wanted to do. I just, probably again, because of my dad, I was always interested in that. In school, we had DECA. It was just like the business club and, participated in that. It fueled me. It energized me. So I went into college with that being the mindset and then just being open to, what different aspects of business would I respond to. And so my first job in school was working for the student life marketing and design department, which basically worked with student orgs and like the bookstore, things associated with the university. And I did web design. And so that was a skill that I had taught myself before, going to college. It was kind of a hobby of mine. And it was something that was nurtured by being, I guess, like actively involved in what my dad was doing. I would go to his office after school and just like around on the computer and like talk to the people worked with, and they would help me through learning about coding and graphic design and things like that. So that skill was not something that I thought would lead to a job, but it did in college. It was something, that seemed more interesting to me than like the standard college jobs. And so I started working at this marketing and design agency, and I kind of learned, I think, by working with other people there, I was really interested in marketing, specifically working with clients, solving problems, being creative. And so what eventually happened is my boss, who I also very much considered to be a mentor at the time, and I do think, to your previous point about like seeing behavior modeled being a way to open up opportunities, I really do think that mentorship was also a very key aspect of like my journey really all the way throughout. And so my boss, who I very much looked up to as a mentor, had this freelance website design gig. And he was like, you know, I don't have time to do this. I have a family. Like, this job is like all that I have time for right now. Maybe you would want to take it. And so he facilitated the intro. You know, I was like, well, let's see what happens. You know, I had never really considered freelancing at that point, but I was like, well, I have the skills. He seems to believe in me. The project seems straightforward enough. Like, I know I can do it. And that really, again, just like going through it, seeing it happen, seeing it, I think it really opened up for me the fact of the matter, which was that, like, I didn't have to work for another organization. I didn't have to work, you know, for a corporate entity. I could do my own work on my own terms.
Yeah. I mean, that's such a big shift to realize that's even an option, to feel like going to business school and you're like, I got to find the best internship. I got to find, you know, the company for me that, of course, we probably in general think is like, I'm going to work there forever, even though a lot of people end up having multiple experiences. So it's like, you're sort of thinking about it one way. And then to have that shift, I mean, that seems like such an amazing opportunity to then also get your feet and kind of try it out. It's not like you're fully committed. It's just like, let me try this out and see how this works and then find traction there. So was he already in marketing, specifically that side gig that he was kind of handing off to you, that was in the marketing space? And then as you took that over, was it all SEO focused, or how did you then start to carve out where you have found your passion in sort of the SEO, the content and writing?
Yeah, so it didn't necessarily factor into that project. That one was a web design project, so it was very much like design and development. But it was, again, instrumental for me taking on other freelance projects, which did help me to discover like more of a love and a focus on the content versus like the container for it, you know, the website and the design, but the actual like written word itself. I guess one other thing that was fundamental or foundational that happened in that job was I was hired to do web design, but my boss, my mentor at the time, he really like gave me permission to pursue other passions. Like, one thing that we did was we always had a photographer at different university events, for example. And so he's like, well, why don't you tag along? You know, you've said that photography is of interest to you. So here's a camera, like, see what you can do. And then another thing that I guess more like related to what we're talking about right now is we had a student life blog. And I think he realized that, like, you know, I was like a chatty person, which is kind of different than the typical web designer who kind of keeps to themselves, you know, pumps out code. And he's like, we have a lot to say. So, you know, if you want to contribute to this blog, like, we're looking for more people. And then like their social channels that kind of went in tandem with that. And so I had a lot of fun, you know, coming up with like different topics that, you know, were appropriate for the university to talk about. It's not like partying or whatever, but like, here's some like, you know, movies that are coming out at the student union, or, you know, like concerts that a certain student org we partnered with or sponsored, like stuff like that. And so that's what made me, I discovered then that I was really interested in that. And that really like energized me even more so than the website stuff. And so I didn't make the connection then, but after I graduated, I took on more freelance projects, and it was anything from website design to social media stuff to writing blog content. And I took a couple full-time jobs, both of them in sales, which I think is worth digging into later because I think that that's really important for starting your own business. But always had these freelance jobs to the side of that. And so I eventually had this client who said, hey, I have enough work for you. You know, you still need to get some more clients if you wanted to like make, you know, more than like a baseline amount to pay your rent and stuff like that. But I have enough work for you. Like, if you were interested in freelancing time, I can make that happen. And he had a lot of, I would say, the content related jobs. And so that was what helped me to make the jump from my 9 to 5 to working for myself. And then it was really later than that that I decided to go all in and not all these like disparate but sort of related different services.
So you started out by really just trying to add as much value as possible across a lot of different marketing areas. So you're trying a lot of things. I think a good amount of people to think about, because I've seen it time and time again. Certainly was true in my life where exposure to a lot of things helps you to, one, have more choices, more options available to you, but also then allows you to find that passion or where you're going to be able to build a business. So getting the sales to social media, to websites, to writing, and all these different things, they may not perfectly relate of like one job does all these, but gave you exposure. Right. And then you were able to turn that into side gigs. The side gigs became the full-time gig. And then later you're able to niche down. I think that sequence is really important for people to pay attention to. Sometimes people on the internet, I think, will give advice like, just niche down immediately. And it's like, that's great. The skills to start a business, you don't know how to sell, for example, maybe that's not your top priorities to figure out your niche. Or, you know, you can spend time on the wrong time. Like, it might be the right thing, but it might be the wrong time. So, you know, you mentioned that sales in particular was a high leverage skill that you added. Did you want that? Focus on that as your full-time gig for a reason? Or did you just, you know, tell me about what you took away from that, how you got into it, and then how that became such a foundational form of leverage for being able to go build your own business?
Totally. Yeah. So I think it's worth also mentioning another job that I had that's a mix of sales and marketing. Was I was a brand ambassador in college for Sony. We had like some different technology reps, so like the Apple rep, the Dell rep, and I was a Sony rep. And it let me kind of play with both marketing and sales. So it kind of piqued my interest, I would say, in that regard. And then kind of as like a side gig, when I got my second sales job, I worked for Zipcar as a brand rep, and we would do activations at events to like sign people up for new accounts and things like that. So that kind of stoked that interest for me. I wouldn't say that I ever went into sales thinking that it was going to be like a full-time lifelong career for me. I really went into it as a foot in the door. That was always my intention. And so my first sales job, Groupon, a couple of my friends, you know, that I had graduated college with had worked there, you know, they'd graduated before me or whatever. And, you know, I'd heard, you know, fun it was. And, you know, the whole like startup life appealed to me at the time. I was, you know, newly graduated, wanting to move to downtown Chicago. And that just seemed like a perfect way to kind of make that happen. And a company that like I had supported previously and thought was doing an interesting thing. So I signed up to be basically like their lowest level sales rep doing warm lead sales, which, you know, for anyone who doesn't know, it's like people that are kind of coming to you and then you just have to close the contract. And I eventually worked my way up to the cold calling sales, which is much harder. And it's, you know, reaching out to people who like maybe don't want to talk to you, lots more rejections and a lot harder to win the business, but ultimately also a lot more satisfying when it does work. And so like, I guess like a good takeaway that I tell anybody who wants to build their own business or freelancing is before you go out on your own, like, first of all, learn from the processes of other people, sales being one of them. But I think that working at that agency in college also was like very important for me because now I run an agency and it's based on the things that I saw there, at least as a foundation, things like, you know, using collaboration, you know, how we talk to clients, how we talk to each other, how we come up with ideas, you know, the technology stack that we use, all those things really originated from what I learned at that job. But in terms of sales, I always tell people to get a sales job before they try to build their own business, because you might as well learn, you know, from somebody else's established process that they've probably paid consultants hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars to develop. And also, you know, it's a low risk test environment for you, because when you start a business, kind of all or nothing, like if you fail, you fail. But if you fail in a job, there are other jobs, you know, you could even go on to get another sales job and try it again somewhere else. But Groupon really provided that really like learning, the important learning, I would say, for testing and developing those skills. And I will say, too, I think it was also important, they offered extra sales training for anybody who wanted it on certain topics. They would have, you know, a special trainer come in and, you know, maybe it had to do with seasonal sales or selling a specific category or whatever. And I always signed up for all those trainings because I just wanted to soak it all in.
I mean, it's such a important way to look at the world. how can I learn the things that are going to set me up to take the next step? You know, there's this sort of concept of being able to build out a toolbox, a set of skills that allows you to do things that you can't do today. It's the concept, you know, the quote that often gets circulated, do what people won't do today so you can do what they can't do tomorrow. And that's,
yeah,
oftentimes people miss that because they want so much to make the highest salary or get the coolest name on the resume or whatever, and don't optimize for acquisition of skills. And then they get 5 or 10 years of their career and they feel stuck because they kind of are. I mean, you can always go add more skills, so you're not truly stuck, but it's right. Like you feel like, oh, but I'm making this much money in this area and this is all I know. And especially with what's coming with AI, you don't want to be totally dependent on just one thing. You need to be able to find ways to add value and to sell that value. You know, I just saw a post the other day on LinkedIn where they were talking about one of the systems that my company works on, and they mentioned, you know, just because someone like that idea got approved doesn't mean it was the best idea. And I said, yep, it means probably the person with the idea was the most convincing. And that's that's what ends up getting done a lot of times in the world, is not necessarily what's the best. It's who's the most persuasive, who can illustrate the point, who can tie a company's, the value they're trying to get and the emotional state they want to feel to what that provides. And so, yeah, I think sales is a starting point. That's some of the best advice you can give. And I give it to a lot of people as well, that if you don't get sales and soft skills, no matter how good you are technically in any area, you're limiting kind of your potential. Because once you go into training, it's a sales job. Like it is. And no matter if you're starting a company, you don't have the difference between an entrepreneur and a specialist that works at a company is the entrepreneur has to acquire the customer. And all of the upside is in who owns the customer relationship. So you don't own the customer relationship if you can't sell. And if you can't sell, you're going to be working for someone who can sell or who has built out a team to sell. So that's really where all the upside of entrepreneurship and ownership is that since you own the relationship with the customer, you have more upside. So I love advice. All right. So you develop a sales skill. Then obviously you're developing some of the marketing skills, some of the actual specialized skills that you're going to offer to value for companies. What do you see as maybe the 2 or 3 highest leverage skills that you developed? Especially, you know, there's this concept that something, you may not be in the top whatever percent in the world in any one area, but if you're in, say, 10% areas, it makes you really rare or really unique. What was that combination of skills for you that made you feel confident that you could go build a business out of?
Sure. Yeah. So this is kind of another, I guess, like side gig or side project that pushed me to where I am today. So while I was at my second sales job, which was also at an agency, so again, learning from their systems and processes, I started a lifestyle blog. It was when I lived in Chicago, it was like how to enjoy, you know, the city on a budget. Because I was a young kid, you know, making a low sales salary. And I was feeling unfulfilled in my job because, again, sales was never the end goal. It was the foot in the door. It was taking me a long time to get to sort of the marketing job that I thought that it was going to get me to. And so I was, what's the word? Like, you know, I was eager and anxious and I wanted to do something with like this energy. So I started this lifestyle blog and my goal with it was to test out different digital marketing strategies to figure out what was going to drive traffic, you know, like what was going to help me grow this product. And then I guess in the back of my head, I was thinking like, whatever that is, I want to get good at it, offer that to other people. Or, you know, at the time, the idea was like, that would be like my in-house job if I could prove that I could do it outside of the job I was actually doing. So this is where I kind of stumbled upon SEO. I was doing, you know, the content, the writing. I already kind of knew that that was something that I enjoyed. You know, that was something I liked spending my time on. But SEO, it was kind of a newer-ish concept at the time. And so I was playing around with it. And one of my favorite stories is, so I used to go to Lollapalooza every year. And I would get in for free because I would volunteer. And I, you know, was consistent every year with it. So they would invite things like that. And I would get like increasingly better assignments. I could like go and enjoy more of the festival. And so I wrote this blog post. And I think like the keyword I used and like the title, which is like very clickbaity, but not untrue, was free Lollapalooza ticket. So I wanted to like show up on the top of search for that specific term. And I did. And I think it actually still ranks like high for that, even though don't quote me on that, but even though I haven't updated it in like many years. But there was something about like, you know, the way that I the way that I approached the SEO, the way that I weaved it in, and the fact that it, you know, wasn't a truly valid way to get free Lollapalooza tickets. And then I kind of had, I guess, like a eureka moment, like, oh, like, you know, this is something that like can be effective. Like, I don't have to have a big budget. I don't have to have a huge audience. Like, if I can sort of like figure out what people want and then give them content that helps them accomplish it. This is, again, a more like clickbaity way of looking at it, but the fundamental idea behind it, like if I can master that, then I have something here. And so I think everything that I've done since that has just built on that in a way that, you know, is really great for the end reader, as well as the brand that's, you know, publishing the content. And the idea is to create like a win-win situation. So everybody's satisfied, everybody gets something out of it. And so, yeah, that happened, you know, right before this client of mine offered me that job that was, you know, quasi full-time to pay my rent, you know, pay for like the basics that I would need to feel comfortable quitting my full-time job. And then I guess like another switch flipped a couple years after that, where I realized that I was doing all these things, social media, website design, content marketing. And I was like, you know, I'm never going to be the best at any of these things. I understand them well. I could do them well, but I can't create like bulletproof processes that stand the test of time and keep up with updates for all of these things. And so I think that's when I realized, you know, content is where I want to be. That's what I want to be great at. And that's when I started to move from like me as this individual, you know, freelancer contractor to then thinking about, you know, maybe I want to do more of like an agency model where we're focusing in on this one thing. I could build processes around that and then I can grow it.
That's awesome. Yeah, I think that's such a key factor for being able to go from maybe freelancer to larger firm consulting for agents. It's being able to make strategic decisions. I mean, everyone has to start, in my opinion, in service-based entrepreneurship. You have to start with just finding a way to add value, because like you can't, at least I'm not the person to talk to. That's how I started. And a lot of the people I've talked to, that's how they started. Maybe there's someone out there that just had a very clear vision. Like, this is the one thing we do. And they scaled immediately. Yeah. Usually the pattern I hear is we started trying to offer a lot of solutions because we had skills in these areas. Finally, we were able to then, once we had a little traction, niche into this is our focus area. And that's fueled our scaling and our growth, because we can standardize those processes and all that. So I think that's such an important concept. And so as you've looked at that and you've gone from, okay, this is something I'm passionate about too, I've built a repeatable process, business, and model around this to help companies thrive, need to take this content-based approach to go grow their company, acquire customers, get in front of people. What would you say, let's say that someone right now is like, wow, that sounds cool. Sounds like a high leverage skill. They want to learn that. What does that process look like? What is it exactly that you guys are doing that makes your service so valuable? Just from the high level process standpoint of what did you get to that now is creating so much value for people?
Totally. I think the biggest thing, and also like the reason that I was able to effectively go from like me on my own to like a team that represents me effectively, is when I started to hire writers, I was still the editor, basically. You know, I still had to put a lot of myself into the process, and it wasn't something that was going to scale, and it was still keeping me bound to like the day-to-day minutiae of the business. And so I was, you know, trying to problem solve, well, like, how do I get out of this? And the answer is like naturally that somebody else is the editor. But the question is, how can they be me? How do I like clone myself? You know, how do I get somebody will take the same standard of care with the content that we're creating so that I don't have to then look over their shoulders too? You know, I really wanted to take myself completely out of the content creation process, but it's a hard thing because it's still representative of me. You know, I stand behind everything we make because it's based on our process, but building the process is why I can do that. And so what ended up happening is I hired our first editor. I had hired a couple of writers, and I worked with that editor to standardize our approach. And so, you know, like Associated Press has their own journalistic style guide that a lot of people use, you know, to create news content, or the Chicago Manual of Style. It's a style guide that many would use to like write a book, for example. So now we have the Blogsmith Style Guide, which is our specific approach to writing content for the web in a way that is clear, that is inclusive, you know, that aims to not confuse, you know, to be straightforward, to not unintentionally alienate people, you know, with word choice. And so it was the process of creating that with the editor. And then now something that, you know, we continue to develop with more writers, more editors, you know, new situations as they arise. But we've really created a solid foundation that I stand behind and that represents my approach to writing, but now like our approach to writing. And I think that the idea of processitizing in general, it also, it goes to everything we do in business. Another thing that I think is unique and distinct about us is we have a very comprehensive keyword research process. So it's not just about finding one primary keyword that we're going after, but it's like, okay, well, what are related keywords? Are there different SERP opportunities that we can optimize for? What, you know, are competitors ranking for? Can we beat them? You know, using different tools that help us to understand the current SERP landscape, what's ranking for a given keyword, what questions do people ask, what are related topics, things like that. So there's a lot of pieces to it. There's a lot of data points we gather. There's a lot of questions that our keyword researchers are answering so that they, when they pass it on to the writer, they have like a really detailed brief of data that they can then use to translate into something that somebody actually wants to read. And then beyond that, I guess the bigger picture that kind of connects that and our style guide is we use a tool called Processtry, and it's basically, it allows you to create workflows. And so, for example, we have like a content creation workflow, and it brings in the keyword researcher, the writer, the editors, the graphic designers, or project managers. And so every step that reasonably happens for any piece of content, they're filling out this workflow, and it also has conditional logic. So, you know, we're going to approach an ebook project much different than a very short form piece of content. So the workflow adapts based on the conditional logic. And it's something that took a very long time to create. And then we made a version 2 of it that took an even longer time to create. But now that we have that in place, there's no question about like what any individual's role is in a project. They just jump in when the checklist pings them that it's their turn, and you know, the last step has been passed on to them.
That's incredible. Yeah, one of these extremely high leverage skills is the ability to use labor leverage. And we think of that as being able to teach, train people to get results on your behalf. And so like where in service businesses, I've found most service businesses start in that exact vein. It's I'm excellent. And now can I get other people to be excellent for me and represent me? And that's really like that first ability you have to develop to build a nice sized service business. And then when that caps out, what happens is for the listeners, you get to a point where you can no longer scale that way because the company is too large for the owner or leader or founder to teach everybody and to constantly do that.
Right.
So the processes have to scale and the executives have to adopt new mindsets, which is then the second form of labor leverage, which is, can I attract, recruit, and then hire people who come in with enough skill already to go do that process on my behalf? Because now I need a growing leadership team that can all do what I just did of teaching, training, and driving that accountability. And that's like a whole other skill set. So you spend all this time starting your business and building that first high leverage skill set, and then you have to go relearn this whole new skill set to be able to get to that next level, which is kind of the fun of entrepreneurship, is that there's always another thing to learn, always another
skill set.
But it's, if you're just an employee, you look at it, you're like, oh, well, I don't know why it's so hard. And it's like, well, there's these hard skills. I have to get all these processes built. I have to get people to do things on my behalf. And then I got to go to the next level, do the next step. And so constant evolution of labor leverage to kind of get the most out of that. Have you seen that in your business where you've sort of transitioned into that phase of having to find people who can do the training on your behalf, who can do the hiring on your behalf, who can, what has that been like as you've kind of evolved into that?
Sure. So I would say like a really key employee. Most of the people who work with me are contractors, which I think works really well for an agency model. It works well with the natural ebbs and flows of business and things like that. But I do have one employee. Her name's Amanda. She's my second in command. And she's, I mean, you know, like the second half of my brain. She compliments me where I fall short, has really great ideas. Like, we can bounce things off of each other. And so Amanda, in many ways, has become like a head of HR. We also have another person, a contractor on the team, Morella, who handles, you know, a lot of aspects of that too. But Amanda's making like a lot of the higher level decisions around it. And, you know, she's the one who tells me, like, yeah, I think we need somebody, you know, to flesh out this role. You know, we need a little bit more support, or, you know, here's a problem here that we need to solve, things like that. So she really like brings those things to me, and then we kind of together to problem solve them. But I mean, I think the good news is like we have created a hiring process for like every major role within the company. And something, maybe this is a good like leverage thing. What we do is, so we have a job description. We work really hard on our job descriptions because we want to be very clear about who we're looking for. And, you know, it's not just about like, oh, do you know these like computer programs or whatever, but it's like, is this the way that you like, is this the type of environment that is going to like be good for you? Because we're remote, we're asynchronous, people in all sorts of different time zones, and you have to be self-motivated at the end. We can't babysit you. So the job description is very important. And then an application that asks like really pointed questions, we're looking for really specific answers. And depending on how people answer that, we invite people to take a paid test. And I think that it's very important, if you're asking people for like any amount of their time, that you do pay for them to go through, you know, some sort of simulated work environment. And so we have a paid test for every one of these major roles. And the way that we see people perform, I think, is very indicative of how they would perform on the team in that role. And of course, there's still training that they have to undergo. They have to get to know, you know, our specific clients. They have to get to know like our different processes, how to work with different team members and things like that. But by having this sort of like, you know, very specific job description, thoughtful answers on the, or thoughtful questions that lead to thoughtful answers on the application, and then really that paint test, you know, it's not often that we have people that are a bad fit that we hire after that point.
That is super insightful. When you talk about the paid test, is this something that you built yourself, or like you give them projects, pay for their time, and have them execute on them? Or is it like a third party that's doing testing on your behalf, where you pay for them to go take, you know, some third party testing that validates certain skill sets? How does that work?
Sure. Yeah. So I've designed all the paid tests, and then also I've also delegated some of them to people on the team. Like, for example, we have like one major project manager, and we wanted to hire like a second for her role, so it would be easier, you know, for her to take vacations and make sure that everything was covered. And so I basically said, like, help us design these questions. Like, here's what we had before, kind of like for this role, and like our first stab at some like very basic questions, but they're out of date at that point. And so, you know, delegating to members of the team, or having them update them, taking a first step and then having them take step has been really useful. The other thing, you know, kind of to the other part of what you said, I use this tool. I think it's rebranded, but it was called Bravo. And it's like one of those quiz software tool type things where you could say like, this is the answer, but you give them, you know, a bunch of options and auto scores it. And you can use AI too. It's like a write it in kind of answer. And you can give it like a sample of what that written answer should look like. And so we use that for, I think, the editor tests and also the writer tests. And we basically set like a baseline score that says if they don't achieve greater than, let's say, 70%, and that's mostly because we don't know how accurate the AI part of it is, but we do know, you know, the rest of it that has one answer, you know, they have to get at least however many right. But that makes it so that we can auto disqualify anybody who's not getting the basic answers right. And then we can go in and check, you know, that those one or two questions that probably need a human to review. So that is a component of the jobs that do require a higher level of detail, I would say.
So I want to touch on just a couple more things before we wrap up. So I love that in terms of tactics for hiring. I think that's super high leverage. Any business owner or hiring manager out there could use that to find better. So I love that. I want to transition a little bit towards two key questions that I want to answer for the audience. One is, what is that state of SEO right. You know, a lot of people, you hear different things. Some people say, oh, SEO is dead now because they used to, you know, go through and had a very defined thing what they thought SEO was. And that got people like yourself who still have, you know, growing businesses in this area. So what? How should business owners or managers or leaders at companies that are listening to this think about SEO? And I assume it's a lot of coincidence that it's so closely related to content for you. So so think about what does the solution look like that for that? And what do people need to be thinking about if they want to actually have a skill or, you know, if they're one, they should reach out to you and get some help on this. What where are you focused in getting value for people there?
Totally. Yeah. No, it's an interesting landscape right now, especially with the advent and the rapid growth of AI. Google's really interesting, too, in how they talk about it. They're a little bit wishy-washy in terms of like things like ranking AI content and how they view it. And, you know, since I've last dug into it, they've also changed some things and made it even more of like a murky water to dig through. So from Google's perspective, it's hard to say. We definitely are seeing AI ranking, you know, even above human content. It is kind of interesting, and I think it's somewhat industry specific. I was talking to my husband about this last night, and he was talking about, he's an engineer, so he's digging into like product catalogs and like very specific use cases and things like that. And he's like, yeah, whenever I'm, you know, searching for an answer for a certain problem, like it just like starts the search engine results page with like AI, you know, just crap. And I was like, you know, it's interesting because I don't necessarily see that in like this B2B tech space. And, you know, maybe I'm not digging into it as much as he is, you know, for his use cases versus mine. But it's, I think that it's also a factor of like maybe there's less content in his industry. And so there's more of an opportunity for the people using AI to create that content and get it ranked. Whereas like in my industry, like we've probably like beaten almost every keyword to death. So there is like a lot of content to choose from. So yeah, I mean, to some extent, it's industry specific. Google is definitely not giving us the full story in terms of their public documentation. One thing that I think is really fundamental that I will say is that Google has always been straightforward about the fact that they want unique content. They want, you know, content that genuinely helps people. They want it to be human first. And, you know, the essential nature of AI is that it's not, and that it's not human either, because a bot is processing it. I see AI content, especially if it's just generated and kind of left at that, I honestly see it as an ethical violation to publish that, because plagiarism to me, it's trained on other people's content. And so if you're not adding anything to it, you're passing someone else's stuff off as your own. And we've seen some different bigger media outlets get in trouble for this. I think CNET was one that published a bunch of what Google refers to as your money, your life content, which they hold to the highest standard because it affects people's livelihood. So it's things like, you know, buying a house or choosing a college to send your child to. And so they had published some, and not only did they find that this article was essentially plagiarized from another one, like they literally like pulled passages from a similar piece, but they also found that this article was misrepresenting the actual formula, so that people using it would have gotten incorrect advice that, you know, could cost them greatly in the long term if they had followed it as if it were the truth. And CNET, I think they were transparent about the fact that it was AI content, but they did say that a human editor proofed it and fact-checked it. And so, you know, I think in a situation like that, it's a little bit extreme, because obviously they admitted it, so people had eyes on them and they were scrutinizing it. And I think it did rank, you know, at least for a while. But then I do think that things like manual penalties from Google happen when people expose, you know, the flaws in specific pieces of AI content. So whether SEO is dead or, you know, however AI affects it, I think Google still has a lot to, we have a lot to learn about how Google's handling it, but I do think that they like manually cleaning up the worst offenders. And so I think at the end of the day, it's totally okay to play around with AI. I think it's a good idea generator. I think it is a tool for leverage and efficiency, but it shouldn't be the start and finish of your process. It should be one small part of it.
Great advice. So I was going to go next into AI specifically, but we kind of ended up there anyway. So I love your perspective on that. And I do think it's going to be very interesting, you know, to see how those interplay going forward. It's all going to be, you know, a whole new world for us to kind of explore together. So I'm very excited by that. So, you know, it sounds like for what you offer to companies, though, you're helping people from strategy all the way through to execution. And AI probably, even if they're heavy using AI, this probably fills only certain of those gaps. And so when you think about a holistic approach, what are the maybe 5 to 7 steps that you're helping companies do from the strategy level all the way down to execution? Makes it to where, you know, they can actually end up on that first page with a result that sure. will drive traffic to their website. Because I have heard this concept of SEO's dead, like essentially, you know, just the best content wins. But I really don't believe that, because we've written some content that I'm like, this is the best, or this is really good. And so it gets nothing. And I'm like, well, we didn't play the game. So what do you see as sort of that set of steps companies need to be taking that probably they're like, for example, you mentioned earlier, doing the right keyword research to understand where there's opportunities. Don't do any of them. If we're, as a consulting firm, wanting to deliver some value, we just know our clients have had this issue, you know, we want to share some value, or it's a subject relevant to our industry, but we don't spend any time on that today. So walk me through what are those main steps that you're helping companies check to be more successful overall?
Totally. Yeah. I mean, I think, and I think a lot of SEOs will say this, but I think that the keyword research should be the first step, because you probably have a good idea of topics that will be helpful to your audience. But if you want them to be properly indexed and then discoverable, then you kind of have to speak the same language as the searchers. And so, like topic generation, I think maybe even comes before that, but it's almost like that. So it's like, I have this idea, but what angle should I take? And I think the keyword research helps to drive. So I would say, you know, yeah, always go in with kind of a plan that's fueled by SEO if you want to get the best results in terms of your eventual distribution and discoverability. So that's really important, because that's kind of like the major parts of the briefs that we give our writers. And so it's like, when a writer starts a project, they're not starting with a blank page. You know, we have ideas for like headings and like, you know, different subtopics we want them to jump into. We have questions for them to answer. You know, we have an idea of how long it should be in order to go deep enough into the subject. And all these things are factors that will eventually help with ranking and things like that. So I think that's a big part of it. You know, in order to stand out in this like AI content driven world, I think that it's important to have the human touch, because it is really, it's hard to discern when you're reading a piece of AI content exactly why it sounds wrong, but there is usually that thought that you get when you read it that like, this is like a little bit off, you know, can't put my finger on it, something just a little bit wrong.
For me, it's like all of the descriptions have three descriptions. It's like it kind, loving, and caring approach to the innovative, revolutionary, and genuine, you know, this. It always seems to put, at least ChatGPT, when I've asked it to write stuff for me, I'm always like, man, you just beat this like a dead horse. Like I read it, I'm like, gosh, cut out half of these descriptions, or like, yeah, there's things like that that just pop off the page where you're like, this doesn't feel like a human ever. A human would not repeat themselves three times in every other sentence.
Yeah. And they kind of like say, yeah, I mean, it's like they keep saying the same thing over and over again, whether it's, yeah, like a thesaurus, or if it's just like rambling around a topic and not adding actual value. It's like, you know, you had to get to word count on your college essay and you're like really close, so you just add a bunch of filler words or something. And like, again, the Blogster Style Guide, we're all about being concise and like staying at then as few words possible, because, you know, the average attention span these days is very short. But also, like, you know, thinking as even like a business owner, it's like, I just need the answer. You know, like I'm interested in the storytelling aspect of it, especially as a content creator, but only if it adds value. I don't need extra filler words. It, you know, again, it's just to get to the word or something. So yeah, so like other steps that are important, I think another big one that comes to mind is like the visual, like art direction. And this is something that I don't think that AI can do yet. And maybe it'll get there. Whenever I've seen, especially ChatGPT generating images, it's like really crazy stuff. like it's not like spelled correctly. It's not the right concept. It's like kind of interesting, but it's certainly not something that I could take and like put into a piece of content I'm creating. And so like we have graphic designers on staff who do illustrations, infographic, you know, nice like quotes featuring experts that we interview and things like that. And I guess that's another really good point too, is like, you know, in order to be unique, especially with all the content that's already written out there, you really should be consulting with experts to create your content. And that could be on the brand's team. It could be using tools like Help a Reporter Out to reach, you know, other experts that are outside of your network, outside of the client's network. So I think that's the thing. Like ChatGPT can't invent interviews with people. Only we can do that as humans, at least right now. You know, there are tools you could use to grab, for example, quotes from podcasts like this one, you know, going through transcripts and grabbing insights. So that is one way that you could source like existing data and probably use AI. But if you want your, if you want to ask your own questions, if you want to dive into a subject from, you know, your own level of curiosity and need, then you really have to conduct your own interviews. So yeah, and then I think again, like thinking about AI and people who are going to use it anyway, it's also making sure you have a really good editing and fact-checking process. And so that's kind of like two different people on our team. We have our editors who kind of defend the blog sort of style guide and make sure that we're following best practices. And then typically our SEOs, who are the ones who do that original keyword research, so they have like dived into the topic, you know, from that high level view. They're helping us to do like fact checking on any sort of like technical things that like the editors have questions about. And so, yeah, I mean, like if you're relying on AI at all to generate copy, you absolutely need to have some piece like that. But you should do it with content that you're creating on your own anyway as well, because if you're publishing something, to me, that means you stand behind it. You want people to be able to trust what you're creating. And you need to make sure that you're not like accidentally misrepresenting something, especially if you grab a stat, right, that maybe a third party posted and it's not the original source. Maybe that third party misinterpreted it and now you're resharing that misinterpretation. So some of this is like journalism skills, going back to the original source, like trying to understand the actual intent. But yeah, I think those are all important pieces of the puzzle that really do take a human to do well.
That's awesome. And it makes me hopeful for better information and better writing. So if people can't learn from this podcast, where do they reach out to you so they can get help from you and your expert team on doing this?
Sure. So we're theblogsmith.com. I'm Maddie Osman on Twitter, or X as they call it these days, but I will always call it Twitter. And then also, I can't change it. And then also check out my book, Writing for Humans and Robots. I'll go ahead and flash it for the screen here. The New Rules of Content Styles is really all about our approach. And it kind of expands on our style guide to give like practical use cases and examples for all the things I talked about.
Well, that's awesome. Thank you so much for coming on, Maddie, and appreciate all the value you shared for the audience, and wish you well as you continue
Absolutely.
To grow.
Absolutely. Likewise, thanks for having me.
Hey, before you go, I have a small request. Our mission is to empower as many people as possible to maximize their potential through the power of leverage. Could you help us in this mission by leaving a review on iTunes, Spotify, or YouTube? And if you know just one person who would benefit from today's episode, would you please share it with them? Your support means the world to us, and we are thrilled to have you in the community. Thank you for being a part of our journey and helping us grow. You can find show notes for today's show and past shows at lessonsinleverage.com, which also has links to connect with me personally and connect with our various podcast channels across your favorite social networks. A big thanks to Solve.cloud, who sponsored this episode. They're a group of expert consultants that help SaaS and financial services companies to implement, optimize, and manage Salesforce.com. They can help you with custom integration solutions and are helping customers to implement some of the most important generative AI technologies. You can find them at solved.cloud. That's solved.cloud is the URL. Thanks again, and we'll talk soon.